Good morning. I call House Special Committee on Fisheries to order. Today is Tuesday, April 16th, 2024. The time is 10:03 a.m. We are meeting in the Max Grimberg Committee Room 120 in the Capitol Building here in Juneau. I ask that you please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Shelby with the Juneau LIO and Cheryl with House Records. Following members present is Representative Hemshoot, Representative McCormick, Representative Stutes, Representative McCabe, and myself, Chair Vance, and we have a quorum to conduct business. We have two items on today's calendar, and that is to hear the presentation on mariculture by Nick Mangini from Kodiak, and then bring back House Bill 297, Sport Fish Angler Access Surcharge by the Governor. So first on our agenda item is the mariculture presentation titled Fishing for Kelp, by Mr. Nick Mangini, who is a commercial fisherman and mariculture harvester from the Emerald Isle of Kodiak. So if you could please state your name for the record and then begin walking us through your presentation.
Yeah, my name is Nick Mangini. I am the mariculture director for Swampsea, but I'm also one of the very first farmers from Alaska, and I'm home based in Kodiak, Alaska. So first of all, thank you for all of your support, both of you. Really appreciate it, all of you. You guys listening and time spent on bills this year. I hope it had been to be here a little sooner, but I think just giving a little background into what we're doing statewide is really important for you guys to know because it'll help you shape our bills going forward. So I'll start a little bit with my business and then move forward from there. So
Nick, do you want to take questions as you go along or wait till the end?
Either way. Yes, thank you. So here's a map of Alaska and the farms that are here today. There's in total 61 farms in Alaska, and 26 of them are kelp only. 8 of them are kelp and oysters. So you can tell that there's a lot more oyster farms happening in Alaska so far. For kelp in general, there's 746 acres happening in the state right now. And then just to give you a little bit of an idea, we started in 2017 with 18,000 pounds, and the latest numbers from 2022, we've produced over 872,000 pounds in that short time, which may not seem like a giant increase, but I promise you that selling 872,000 pounds is the biggest thing that we're up against as far as mariculture and kelp in the state goes right now.
Well, you already have questions, Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Through the chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Morning, Nick. So how many, you said 60 kelp farms, how many of those are oyster farms as well? Do you know the number?
Through the chair. 61 total mariculture farms, which means kelp and oysters statewide. 26 of those are kelp only, and eight are combo. So there's 34 total just kelp and oysters, which I'm not sure what that means, leaves 27, something like that.
Wait a minute, you said, through the chair, you said 26 kelp only, 8 combo.
Yes.
So how do you get 34 total combo?
Well, 26 and, or I'm just saying through the chair, 34 are kelp and oyster, okay. You know, they're
right.
34 of those are not oyster only.
That okay, so there's 34 combos.
No, there's 34, there's 26 kelp and 8 combo. So whatever that remaining number is
oysters.
Yes.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have clarified better. I had it written down on another notepad there. So just wanted to give a little bit of background mostly. And in Kodiak, in Kodiak itself, we've only had two processors in the past through 2022, but because of money coming in from Build Back Better and Joint Innovation Projects through AFDF, we're going to have 5 to 6 different processors doing primary stabilization methods in Kodiak this year. So it's showing that things are ramping up. People are getting excited and recognizing that there's, in particular, 4 areas of the state that are well positioned to do this kind of work. This is my company, Kodiak Island Sustainable Seaweeds. And Kodiak Island Sustainable Seaweeds, we've had a number of different objectives throughout the years. Mostly it started from me being a commercial fisherman and losing opportunities in Kodiak and becoming further and further away from where I wanted to live and where I want to do business. And I wanted to build a new industry or a new economic driver in my hometown. I had no idea that we would, I never dreamed that we would get to where we are this quickly, to be honest. I kind of started it as almost a hobby. Very quickly, I was wrapped up into a project by ARPA-E that explored biofuels and how closely together we could plant kelp. It showed really strong promise for Alaska. We quickly moved away from biofuels and kind of focused on how densely we could populate farms, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But we've done a number of different projects from farm food to biofuels to compost methods, even put kelp in concrete last year to see a, try to figure out if we could actually sequester the carbon, which I thought was a really interesting project. But turns out everybody that's in this industry is really interested in trying really crazy off-the-wall things, which is pretty exciting. So this is my site location. Any of you that are familiar with Kodiak, as I've talked to Representative McCabe, you can see where you used to take your planes off over there at the floatplane dock, and it's just outside the harbor there up against this island. I chose this site because I thought it would be really good for research, and again, I never thought that this would be commercially viable as quickly as it was. I think that part of the reason it's commercially viable for me is because I was one of the first ones. There's newer farms are having a lot of trouble figuring out who to sell this to and how to sell this to, where I had the distinct advantage of being first, so I brought in a market early and have since kept that market. This is the starting stage of life cycle of kelp. We're required to harvest 50 fertile plants. So you can see these fertile pieces on the left on the paper towel. They turn real dark and get kind of iridescent around the edge. And that's like spores that are hidden, or, you know, that the kelp releases. You put it into a vat and they release that into the water, and then you take it, I messed up here, you take it into a hatchery setting. You can see these tanks on the right have seed string in the tanks. They release those spores into the tanks, and eventually it starts to look like the picture on the left, the seed string under a microscope. Pretty interesting process. There's lots involved.
Representative Himshue.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is a not very important question, but I'm just curious. Is that a closed loop system then? Because otherwise the spore would just go out on an open loop. So, but you are, you have to circulate the water. Like, this is a pretty complex system.
Yeah, through the chair. Yes. I'm not as privy to the hatchery techniques because I've been on the farm side of things. Although from, in my experience, there's a couple different ways. Yes, there is flow through and there is closed loop systems. I believe in the setting of the seed part, it's almost always closed loop. So in essence, they take a PVC pipe and wrap kite string around it really tight, so there's no gaps, and it's about this long. And that's the seed. That's the string you see on the left. They set that into that vat full of the spores, and those spores settle on the string. And then this was the original farm or original hatchery set up at the NOAA lab, in Kodiak, and they change the water out weekly and add some nutrients and remove and add light as needed so that the kelp grows for about 6 to 8 weeks in the hatchery. Pretty complicated process, but also sort of simplistic. It's like a little bit of both, you know. So at that point, we take it out to the farm, and this is us this year seeding my farm in Kodiak. You can see the pipes coming off of the boat there, and the string goes around the long lines. A lot of people think that we're harvesting wild kelp, and that's just not true. And we have to, you know, obey the laws put forth by DNR and Fish and Game to make sure that we're not taking kelp from areas outside of where we're growing it, and that we're not choosing parent plants to make ours strong, you know, this, the kelp that we're growing stronger than what it should be representatively.
I'd like to let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Johnson at 10:13 a.m.
So this is what I really want to talk to you guys about, mostly more than the life cycle and all of that of kelp, is more the design, so that you understand what the permitting, what we're permitting and what these structures look like and mean. So this is a single and a double catenary design that was developed by Tend Ocean out of Maine. This is what my farm looks like because of the RPE project. And as you can see, it's a fairly complicated system that relies on the same basic idea as a suspension bridge. So by using a catenary design, we can distribute the weight of 55 lines to those single anchors on the edges so that we don't have to individually anchor every line, which would be very expensive. And the idea is that by doing things like this, that you can duplicate it to make double, triple, quadruple catenaries to save on expenses of anchors, because anchors are about our most expensive part. These stand up yellow and green, it's called a spar buoy. It's actually inflatable with air. They're about 16 feet tall, so I can pull up to it with an air compressor in my boat and fill it up to raise the catenary to the surface, and then subsequently let the air out to sink it underneath the water so that most boats can drive over it. We don't really want fishing vessels driving over the top of what we're doing, but the everyday boater should, in most cases, be able to at least access or be around the farm. This is a little bit more technical look at what the farm design looks like. It was a very well thought out system and has since been adopted and duplicated all over the state. I think it's our strongest method, although there is a number of farmers looking to do it in different ways. And the picture on the right is what a drone view of the actual farm looks like from 100 feet.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, how far offshore is your farm?
Through the chair, not extremely far. I'm about 100 yards off of Pop-Off Island. And if you left Dog Bay Harbor, you can be at my farm in 2 minutes.
Oh, wow.
So I'm in about 60 feet of water. But there is also some farms further offshore at Woody Island. There's one behind Calson, and I know not everyone knows what I'm talking about. But there's a number of farms that are further offshore, and it's more of a depth issue. That's why Kodiak's got a real strong place in mariculture, because of our shallower depths, as opposed to there's really steep angles here in Southeast. Not that there's not good places to farm, that's not what I'm trying to say. I just mean it complicates things when you don't have flat, shallower areas.
Follow up. Thank you. So what depth is an ideal depth?
Through the chair, that's hard to answer. I would say no deeper than 200 feet, because responsibly, we're supposed to use 3-to-1 anchoring. So when you start getting deeper than that, then the expenses, I mean, that's an entire coil of line for one anchor line. So it starts getting expensive fairly quick. And then dropping an anchor in 200 feet of water is a lot harder than 60 feet. And knowing what those substrates are, not to say that it's not possible to do really deep, it's just going to be really expensive to set up those farms. And then another thing about the way that we lease our farms right now is that through DNR, my lease, I have to lease where my anchors are. So my site is 17.8 acres, but my footprint of my farm on top of the water, what you're seeing on the left, is only 4 acres. And that's pretty much maximizing the size of my farm, because I have to pay for that scope in my anchors, even though there's nothing on top of the water. So it adds a significant expense. So you start getting out deeper, you're going to have to go 600 feet, and that's a lot of area to not be able to use. Now, there is screw anchors and things like that that can make it possible to almost go straight up, but it's just starting to be added now. We're so young here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
These were both videos that aren't going to be able to show. So this is a little bit more idea of what it starts to look like during grow season. You can see from the top of the water on the left here, you can start to see the plants. This is probably a month and a half, 2 months into the grow season, and the large farm view is shot from a float plane flying over my site maybe 2 weeks before I harvest. So you can see there's some significant growth there. It really, really adds to the overall ecosystem around it. Becomes these big halos of life. There's baby salmon hiding in there. We've seen full-size salmon. In Kodiak, you haven't been able to catch very many shrimp anymore, but there's shrimp all over inside of this stuff, and I think it's just they're feeding on the smaller microorganisms that are calling this home. So it really is adding to the entire environmental process happening around our farms. This is one of my favorite slides because it's just about monitoring growth, but the very small kelp on the left is only 3 weeks younger than the picture on the right. So that's just an idea about this time of year, how much growth you can get and how quickly it can happen. So that also is something for the farmers to keep in mind because it adds significant weight to your lines. We've had an entire farm go underwater because we didn't have enough flotation on it before, and we had to go kind of fish it up. It didn't drift away all the way, but we needed to add a lot more flotation. So there's a pretty steep learning curve as far as the farming goes, because it's really hard to wrap your head around how fast this stuff grows. I mean, it's really an amazing thing.
Representative Suits.
Thank you. As you can see, thank you, Madam Chair. I have lots of questions. I'll try and just throw them in every now and then. So is there much maintenance from the time you put the seed string out to the time you harvest?
Through the chair, yes. Early in the season, not as much, dependent on storms. One of the methods that I've been personally using in my farm is to add less flotation in the beginning, because then you catch less things that are drifting, like bull kelp and logs and things like that. You don't have to have as much stuff interacting with things floating on top of the water. And early on, it's not hard to keep that line before it has growth in that optimal 6 to 12 foot growing area underneath the water. As the season progresses, you have to add, like the CCO picture on the right. So early in the season, I might only go out once every month, maybe 3 weeks, but my farm in particular is special because I can see it from the road. So I can pull down in a certain spot in town and look directly down my buoys and tell if there's any problems at my farm just because of the way I've set it up. Not everybody has that option, so it's highly suggested that once every 2 weeks be the minimum of monitoring.
Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So is there just one growing season, or do you just continue to roll through? Is there a particular time that it grows best, I guess?
Through the chair. We've tried a number of different things. We've planted out in October and let it grow till May and had really, really good success. We've planted in November and had it not show up as well, but then we planted in January and had really good success too. So it seems to be more about the nutrients in the water that are prevalent, so that's a lot of what we're learning. There's also probably some complications that come from outplanting when we have the least amount of light, like mid-December. There's diatoms that cover the lines, so it just turns into a big dark slime, basically. And when you have a baby kelp that's, you almost can't see, I think it just has to compete with those diatoms and doesn't break through as well as it should. So I tried outplanting all the way into March this year. It seems to be growing fine. We would like to explore maybe doing multiple harvests a year. I know that they're thinking about doing this in Maine, which is kind of where we've taken most of our lead from. So it would be nice to try to start earlier in the season, but then also that starts to complicate other people's uses. There's still people silver fishing in some of these areas, especially for the kelp-only farms. Oyster, if you have oysters, it's something that's out there all the time. What we're hoping is that people are responsible in the way that they permit, and that we can get together localized groups to share what we're trying to do and where these things are trying to happen, so that we infringe on the least amount of public use as possible. But I personally think that you could potentially do 4 harvests of bull kelp, especially in a year. Maybe not a full-size bulb, but there's lots of alginates and compounds within that bull kelp that's shorter that could be used in a variety of different markets.
Cool, thanks.
Representative Himshute.
Thank you, Chair Vance. Through the chair, I'm curious about the life cycle of the kelp. So you have to reseed it. It doesn't just keep growing in perpetuity, because when you, and I'm sure you're probably getting there to the harvest part, but you harvest and then can you go back and harvest again?
Through the chair, there's a number of different methods. Right now, we have not figured out how, well, I shouldn't say figured out. It has not been tried to do multiple harvests, especially for the kelp you're looking at here is sugar kelp. It's actually extremely fragile on the line and is really easy to break loose. And it slides down and becomes really heavy, and it's a real pain in the butt to get off there, to be honest. So until we crack that nut and figure out how to like haul it and harvest half of it, especially because the bottom part of the plant is the oldest. So the youngest part of the plant's coming from, you know, the roots or the holdfast, if you will. I think there's definitely some other species that Alaska's just starting to dip into. We're getting ready to do the first commercial outplanting of a kelp called dragon kelp. It floats and it has a stipe. So it has like a stem down the middle of it that has little floating pockets in it. That definitely has the option to harvest the top 20% and leave, and then, you know, continually do that. We don't know that we can do that because it's never been done, but Macrocissus, which is a giant kelp, has been proven to be able to do repeated harvests in California for a long, long time. So there's definitely kelps within Alaska that we could do this on. But yes, right now we have to reseed.
Follow up. So through the chair, we don't seem to have many kelp farms taking off in Sitka. I'm just curious if that's due to the herring. Like, is there anything that comes in and spawns in your kelp? And if it does that ruin your harvest?
Through the chair, yes. There's some laws in place that if the herring spawn on them, I can't remember the exact day. It's like 28 or 32 days. Until there's no remnants of the spawn left on the kelp, you're not allowed to touch it. And as you can imagine, it's really detrimental to the look and overall, I don't know. The kelp doesn't look very good after that happens. There's been some talk of maybe putting kelp farms in places like Prince William Sound, where they had troubles with their herring rebounding, to give them more area and things to spawn on, just to never harvest. But so far, that's about all it's been is talk. As far as Sitka goes, really close to my heart because I graduated high school there, but I don't know. It's tough because I was also a herring fisherman, and I know there's no way to predict where the herring are going to go or spawn or any of those things. I think there's some really cool spots that you could do it in Sitka, but it's kind of up to whoever's there and what their access to those areas may be.
Follow up.
Through the chair, which is near and dear to my heart too, but so is Prince of Wales, and that's where a lot of the development seems to be, is down in Prince of Wales. So I know that they've had herring down there, and I know that they are hoping herring will come back more. So it's just, I'm curious if you just avoid that season or what you do. So if they have spawned and you wait until that date, and is the kelp still usable after you wait long enough for the eggs to hatch?
Yeah, through the chair, I don't have a lot of experience. I know it happened on a very large scale farm that's in Craig the second year they were in business. I never really followed up with what he was able to save from that farm, but I know that it wasn't a good thing. So I think that there is probably some options. Yeah, you could probably harvest in the end of March, or, you know, before you know those spawning events are going to happen. There's been talk of setting up bubble machines on the farm, at the edge of the farm, to try to deter the herring away from it. But you are creating the perfect spawning situation in an area that doesn't have to deal with tide, which in my experience as a herring fisherman was a lot of what the herring would wait for. You know, they want a crystal clear day and a low tide, and that's when they're gonna hit the beaches, because they know that their eggs will be safe in those areas. So yeah, that's a tough one. The these are also animations, but this is, the file's not correct. So it's actually a pretty cool video of just how close together the lines are and what the underwater growth looks like. You know, you get blades of sugar kelp in particular that can be very full. We had almost 8 pounds a foot of line, and we had 55,000 feet of line out on this particular video. So it was a large amount of biomass. Just kind of a really cool visual of what it looks like under the water. And then the other video was us harvesting at a very early stage. And then these are kind of a couple pictures of what the biomass was looking like in the beginning. The one on the left is a picture of how we were harvesting in a skiff in the beginning. We were actually using the power of the outboard to push ourselves forward and just trimming with a knife as it went over a higher spot. And then the other one on the left is using harvesting 5 lines at once, using mechanical spinning blades onto a seiner and just trying to industrialize what we're doing. These are also some more harvesting pictures. We switched to a 1 line and started harvesting it into the water and then flipping this cage up so that we weren't having to bring the kelp out of the water because of reasons I stated earlier. The sugar kelp in particular likes to break loose from the line when it has any resistance on it. So we were having trouble getting all of that kelp onto a boat. So we figured, why not just harvest it into a bag in the water and then flip it up on the boat, which worked well as well. And then the other picture is a pretty far distance, but it's an animation as well of a thing that we developed through ARPA-E that's called the Harvest Buddy, which is a pontoon boat that moves up and down the lines as you harvest, and you can kind of drag along bags with you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So you said bag. Are you talking like a Kevlar cement bag, or are you talking like a real fine mesh net that lets water out?
Yeah, through the chair. Off the back of the boat, we were using just salmon seine web, basically, as a big bag to catch it. You can see on the back of the seiner here on the next slide that there's Nomar bags like they use in Bristol Bay. So that's what we've kind of developed now, is a Nomar bag with a lid on it. So we'll harvest the kelp into there. You can get about 800-900 pounds a bag. The reason we didn't use the Kevlar style bags or super sacks was because they don't like to empty water as much, and you need pretty significant, it's surprising actually, put 800 pounds of kelp in there, put it in the water, it's like 3,000 pounds of water, and not everybody can lift that with a skiff. So this is just representative of how far we've come in 6 years. You know, we used to drive in with 3 totes full of kelp, and now we're delivering 20,000 pounds of bags in a few hours. So it's pretty nice to be able to put that commercial fishing, you know, knowledge to use as well. These are a few pictures of me, and you know, just at the end of the season, we're happy farmers when we have these nice, full, beautiful products that Clean Waters of Alaska are producing, and I hope that we can start to take advantage of. So this is just a little bit about my company in particular. This year I'm growing four varieties of kelp, Alaria, Sugar, or Ribbon, Sugar, Bull, and Dragon. I've been a part of Department of Energy, ARPA-E project. As I stated earlier, the kelp feed project through Denali Commission was funded. And that was a really exciting outcome. We're just starting to see the results of that, where they took kelp and created a swine feed. They sent it to one farm in particular in South Dakota. So they took the raw wet kelp, fermented it, sent it to South Dakota, co-fermented it, fed less than 1% of this feed to pigs. And the pigs from a farm of 2,300 pigs had an increased value of $280 per sow because of their piglet production, which equated to nearly $600,000 for that one farm in particular. So we would like to duplicate this in the future with a farm that has about 23,000 pigs, which would equate to around $30 million of increased revenue. So it could be a major, you know, industry going forward, just creating pig feed. That one project would need 1.8 million pounds of wet kelp So over double what we've ever grown in the state, and almost double of what the leading state, which is Maine, grows currently, with about 40 farms. So that was one thing in particular that I was really excited about.
Representative McCabe.
So thanks. Through the chair, how many animals have you tried this on? I mean, it's, you know, pigs, obviously, but horses, dog food. I mean, there's seems like it works for pigs. There would probably be quite a few animals that you could supplement their feed with.
Yeah, through the chair. It's a project I just supplied the biomass to, so it wasn't really my choice what it went into. The original idea was to provide it to both cattle and swine. The early indications that the company, they were out of the Faroe Islands called Ocean Rainforest, they had done a project in Europe and got really excited about the pigs. And it's all about the piglet mortality. So the sows were on average producing 4 or 5 more piglets per birthing cycle, which is where the increased revenue comes from. It also does a lot for their gut biome. So they were putting nearly 50% less antibiotics into the pigs, and the pigs were eating on average about 25% less food to get the same amount of nutrition. So it's all about what the kelp does for the stomach. It's like a pre and a probiotic. And I really think it's a promising thing for the future of mariculture in Alaska. We don't know what the price point is, which is the sticky part. You know, it's hard to get paid real well through grants like this because you have to create the product, which sucks up most of the money. I don't know that anyone would want to produce 1.8 million pounds for 25 cents a pound. It's at least with where we are on the production level, it would be pretty hard to break even. And with the cost of leases and the cost of the equipment it would take to grow that in the short term.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Through the chair, you said you grew 4 different kinds. Is there different uses for the different kinds of kelp?
Through the chair, that's kind of why I'm growing. I've only grown 2 in the past. These are the same 2 that are kind of grown all over the world, but we have these very specific kinds of kelps that only grow here in Alaska. So I would like to look into why are we not taking advantage of that? You know, if they can grow sugar kelp almost anywhere in the world, then we should probably not be focusing on that. I think we'd find the strengths in the kelps that only grow here and figuring out what the different compounds are and uses in those. Because biostimulants and nutraceuticals and all of those markets depend on different types of brown algae as well. So.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what would the ribbon kelp, can you give us an example of what that might be used for?
Yeah, through the chair. So if you've had miso soup, you've had wakame, which is what? That's Alaria or ribbon kelp. So a ribbon kelp is the Alaska equivalent to what they grow in Korea and Japan and call wakame. Sugar kelp is kombu. So that's more of a dried species. And then Korea grows, I don't know how many millions of pounds, but 70% of it goes into their abalone feed. So we went there last year and they take 70% of their overall growth and just feed their abalone because they're so dependent on their abalone for their food security.
Can you speak to some of the other uses? You mentioned that there's a shoe company looking at kelp. I mean, there's so many uses for kelp. I think that's something that we kind of need to, this is emerging market, and you've been participating in different grant projects and research. Can you just talk more about that and the different uses of the kelp?
Yeah, Representative Vance. Yes. They asked us not to say who they were as a shoe company, but what I can say is a giant multinational shoe company. It kind of blew my mind that they wanted to see what we were doing. But they have, a lot of these companies have these carbon zero goals, and theirs in particular is 2030, which is very aggressive. I wasn't at all privy to the information of how much or how carbon intensive foam and rubber in the soles of shoes is. So they're really looking for some replacements for that. And they wanted to see the carbon footprint of what we were doing more than they wanted to see what was in the actual kelp, if that makes sense. I think they know that they can make different textiles out of this. They've proven that they can make leather. There's a company in San Francisco that's making a cellophane that's clear and first of its kind, 100% out of kelp, which is pretty exciting. Compostable. There's a lot of packaging. There's, like I said, the food, you know, the livestock feed's a really exciting one. And I know that I'm focusing just on kelps here because that's my particular expertise, but oysters are really exciting for a lot of these things too. And the ROI on oysters is pretty magnificent, really. You can make your money back pretty quick on oysters, and they're also really helpful in the carbon area. And nearly 100% of the oysters grown in Alaska stay in Alaska right now, which I never really knew until the last year. There's a very small amount of them leaving the state. So that lets you know how much room there is for growth.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Is Eric still growing oysters in Kodiak?
Yeah, through the chair, yes. He's expanded to, in Larson Bay, which was, there was a very small scale farm in Antones a long time ago, but never really grew much. And then, he's produced quite a bit. So it's exciting to see that they're doing these things in places that people thought you could never do it before because of red tide and things like that.
Representative Hemshue.
Thank you, Chair Vance. Through the chair, I'm curious about shipping. That's always such a barrier for producers of anything in our state. So are you shipping wet kelp, which would be extremely heavy? Are you drying it? Is it? I know there's a company looking to start up in Naugatuck, Prince of Wales, and they're planning to send out a liquid concentrate fertilizer kind of thing. So what are you doing for shipping, and is that a barrier?
Through the chair, probably our largest barrier, yes. Especially if you're going to ship something that's 90% water to Seattle just to dry it. The economics of that don't make sense unless it's worth hundreds of dollars a pound, which it's just not. So finding creative ways for shipping those, for shipping these things, or finding economical ways to dry them in the places that they're being grown would probably be our best path forward.
Follow up.
Thank you. Through the chair. So is drying it like a universal solution to almost everything that's made from kelp? Can we send it mostly dried out so you would just need the energy intensive drying capacity? And would that meet the need of most of the growers or the people that you're supplying to? Can it be reconstituted easily, and is drying a solution to that cost?
Yeah, through the chair, I think it really depends on what you're making, which is a lot of what we're trying to find out through this Build Back Better program that we're doing. There's a lot of marketing research being done. There's a lot of primary stabilization projects being done. And the short answer is yes, I hope so, because it will make it a lot easier. But also there's products that, you know, need to remain wet, or, you know, biostimulants is really removing the biosolids and being able to sell that removed water. So it really depends on what the product is. I wish there was a silver bullet, because I think we wouldn't be here asking you guys for any help.
Did I get to you, Representative McCabe?
Thanks. So, yeah, it would seem like Kodiak's a pretty hard place to dry things. Having lived there for 17 years, I'm just now drying out. But what I'm curious about through the chair is actually marketing. So you mentioned marketing a second ago, and I'm wondering, you know, our seafood industry has me, obviously. I'm wondering if you have developed, or if there is a budding marketing agency for, you know, this stuff. Obviously, oysters could go under ASME, I suppose, but kelp, I don't know. I'm interested to know, or would it be something under ASME that would be helpful? You knew I was going there, didn't you?
We've had this conversation, haven't we, Nick?
Through the chair. I honestly think it might be the other way around, or at least that's the way that the industry would like it to be, because kelp needs a lot of help, and oysters already sell themselves. And the oyster farmers kind of know that and don't really want to pay a tax or something that they don't have a problem selling 100% of, where we're in the very opposite end of that. I think a lot of these companies are startups, and the cost of business in Alaska has been too overwhelming before there was this financial help that we're seeing through Build Back Better. So I really think that we're going to start to see these companies kind of come out of their shells and dip their toe into Alaska. It's already happening, like I said, in Kodiak. We got 5 different people doing primary stabilization, and you know, they're using 3 different facilities. 2 of them are sharing one facility. So that's one of my personal dreams, is to see these companies work together and share facilities to build up some infrastructure on our water, because that's what we need. But as we all know, the seafood industry in disarray, and they're trying to sell these plants, and they're not trying to sell them cheap. It's still at a premium. And to put a, you know, to buy a $32 million plant for some, you know, as a startup company is nearly impossible. So I think that's the uphill battle we're seeing. The companies that are making these products have been fairly successful if they're coming to Alaska, but they're all such different areas, you know. These biorefineries that are kind of taking all of the compounds and everything within the kelp and splitting it up to make these different products. And then you have hyper-focused, you know, I want to make this kimchi out of kelp. That's an example of a company out of it. Atlantic Sea Farms out of Maine. So they basically ferment and pickle it and leave the kelp wet, so that they're not losing any of the value that they paid. And then you have, you know, like Barnacle drying some of their stuff to put in to their different spices and things like that. So it really just depends. And I think it's all up to really the person buying the kelp, how they market it. I think we need to figure out how to market Alaskan kelp for sure, though, because just like our seafoods, it comes from some of the most pristine water in the world.
I have had this conversation with the mariculture groups and about joining ASME, and ASME as a board has a number of years ago said yes, we would welcome, you know, them joining and being able to promote them. But there is a disagreement, if you will, that the oyster growers, like Nick said, don't feel the need to be a part of ASME, and we're working on maybe having a carve out that allows the industry to join when they're ready to do the self-assessment. But if we can open up in statute that allows that process, that's something that we've discussed as a favorable way to move forward. So ASME's open to it. It's just a matter of the industry being ready.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I can't speak for all oyster farmers. That's just, you know, I'm talking about that particular event we were at in Homer. There seemed to be some very big disconnect in the room, and that's a large area of growers. I think as millions of more oysters come on in the next few years, you might see a change in that thought. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not as easy to sell 100% of what you're growing within the state. I hope that's not the case, because I really love the idea of small farms, and they love this lifestyle. It's like set netting a lot, you know. It's not, yeah, it's about the financial part of it, but it's also about the lifestyle of living remotely and depending on, you know, our environment to sustain you and giving back to that, and everything about it. Most of these are not happening in big cities, or they're all happening fairly remote.
Well, I know that you have an 8-minute video.
I do.
And I want to allow you do that. And then after the video, we can see if there's any more questions.
Okay. It's a fairly goofy video, to be warned. So do I have to move the mic like this?
I think Jake has the other mic set up for you already.
Oh, sorry. So a little background. World Wildlife Fund came and did a story about me in particular and my transition from fisherman to kelp farmer. And just, I think it's really representative of not every kelp farmer, but a lot of us and our mission and why we're here and just the potential for Alaska. So.
is that? What is it at Men's League in Kodiak, Alaska? Some of my best friends in the world. In a town this small, you gotta find things to make it fun. It was real bad. Nothing Carol can't fix. Come on, Carol.
Kodiak is my favorite place in the world. I've been a lot of different places, but this place feels like home, and there's really no place quite like it. I've been commercially fishing for 25 years in Kodiak, Alaska. As I've seen the options for fishing in Kodiak disappear, and you look at the history of Kodiak and how we were once the king crab capital of the world, and now it's really hard to catch a king crab here. I mean, just the instability of the fisheries is scary because of the climate. Cod eggs are not surviving in the warmer waters. Cod for me was my bread and butter. I depended on the ocean for 30 years, and so I felt obligated to try to give something back. And I think that's where this comes from. Just something that I can do to give back to something to sustain my family. I think that's what excites me about kelp a lot, is that it's generally a shoulder season for a lot of these fisheries. I think that it creates a big opportunity for fishermen in the area to have something else to do.
Man, that's like the best clarity we've had in a long time. Just throw it past that buoy a little ways. Whatever it hooks on, we'll just pull it up with that. Kodiak, to me, came as an accident.
Yellen?
Bring it over the bow. I had a lot of friends from here, and I came here with an ex-girlfriend. Walk this way just a little bit more.
We didn't work out, and I was broke, so I kind of got stuck here. And started fishing and fell in love. Sorry, Chris. It just became something that I really couldn't stop thinking about. I want to see this industry have a place in Kodiak and a mainstay in Alaska. And it'll allow me and others like me to stay near on the water.
Because I'm a cowboy.
Let's go grab another one, check it out. We'll just go that way like 3 or 4 lines. I was born in Redwood City, California. We left before my first birthday, and my parents settled in Bend, Oregon. At the age of 14, we moved to Sitka, Alaska, where my dad took a job as the general manager of a distributorship, and my mom continued her career as a nurse. From the moment I held a fishing pole, it was all that I wanted to do. So Sitka really did fit me perfectly. You're done with all this stuff. It can be washed, right?
Yes, please. And really capture this, because Nick doing the dishes is a very rare occasion.
On a rare occasion, that's not true.
What's up? Hi.
Hi, honey.
Do you guys want to cook dinner as a family like we always do?
My wife Stephanie helped her aunt with a daily radio bit called Fish Radio. The show aired throughout Alaska and dealt with issues, news, and events surrounding fishing.
This is Fish Radio. I'm Stephanie Mangini. A type of seaweed that naturally tastes like bacon is quickly becoming the it new superfood.
Steph decided to do a piece on kelp bacon, and that kind of led me to a rabbit hole about kelp farming and what they were doing in Maine.
Researchers are finding that it tops another leafy green superfood, kale.
It's much more nutritious than kale, for sure.
And I just thought it was really interesting and thought, why shouldn't we be doing this in Alaska? Which led me to being one of the first here in our state.
Okay. Holy crap.
That's a better looking line, right? My brother-in-law, Eric, had already done a lot of the homework on a site close to town, so it really helped me to expedite the process.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful.
I got the application in through 3 1,200-foot grow lines of sugar and ribbon kelp, and that netted about 10,000 pounds, which was Alaska's first commercial harvest. When I pulled up my first line of seaweed, I was surprised to say the least. it's just really hard to wrap your head around how fast this stuff grows, especially that last 3 weeks in April.
Ooh, right here is a good one. This has got to be...
It's all the things that the market wants, nice and dark brown. When the sugar kelp gets nutrient starved, it turns really light and like almost golden in color. So when you get nice dark blades that are big and wide like this, it's a good sign. I like the challenge personally, so to me that was a big part of the allure of kelp farming. To have the opportunity to grow an industry from the ground up is something special that you don't get very often.
It's crazy. It's like you never thought it would have been interesting, but it's pretty interesting.
Like the last thing in the world I thought I was going to do is try to get kelp onto a boat. I mean, never in my life did I think that was going to be part of my everyday job. And here I am. Like, who am I? It's pretty good, too. After my first year, I expanded to a 17-acre site in the same location, and we grew around 30,000 pounds.
Oh, man, look how good the bull kelp's growing. So this is a species that everybody wants to know how to farm right here because it's starting to disappear. Look how long that is. I mean, the biomass here is insane. This is like a 40-pound freaking thing. Pretty cool, huh?
I'm always looking to grow as a company, although the landscape of processors and processing in Alaska is not growing at the same rate as farmers. So we are kind of outpacing the market. I went to Blue Evolution as my market in the beginning, and they've since put roots in Kodiak, created a ton of jobs, and I have deals in place to work with them through the foreseeable future. Since I've lived in Kodiak, I've watched fisheries collapse, the canneries consolidate to a point where new opportunities for families that live here just don't exist. And I really just hope that this could be, you know, where mariculture finds its niche within our community.
What's up, big dog? How are you? And how's things?
I fell in love with Kodiak and the people here, feeling the closeness and the sense of community that exists here.
Ray's shirt is so amazing.
It's so great.
Imagine if he sat on our old couch, he'd be like, "Kim,
I got out of fishing just because I didn't want to spend 6 months away from my family anymore.
I love you though.
I all of a sudden was in Dutch Harbor for most of my year or ended up on the coast of California for 11 months. And it's just not why I started doing this. And I wasn't a part of my own family. Yeah, I just want to leave my kids a better life. What can we do to make this a better future for them? Now that they're moving out and getting ready to go on their own, it's really scary. I guess to just leave any legacy on Alaska that really creates a new economic driver would be something that I could be really proud of. I always said if I wasn't a fisherman, I would try to get more involved in the community. So I think this is just maybe a little entrance point to that. Kelp has its place in trying to remediate climate change in one way or another. What can we do to use this just as a tool to help curb climate change, really?
Thank you. Any further questions from committee members? Representative Carpenter.
Through the chair. Totally jazzed. I love your farm. I've got a little peony farm myself. So trying to keep my rows straight when I was putting them in, I could feel for you. Yours probably are a lot straighter because they're rope. You grow kelp, but what's the product you sell?
Through the chair. Right now, it is mostly all blanched and frozen to go into an ingredient market. But as we've produced the feed product. Last year, we did a composting trial because Kodiak has a large-scale composting for our human waste. It's obviously not used for vegetables or anything like that, but it is usable in landscaping. So they were putting around 6,000 pounds of kelp that I wasn't able to sell into this compost every week, and it was showing really good signs of it making it better. So at this point, it's kind of a balance between what they need for food. If anybody else comes in with any late run products, I haven't done that much value add myself, but there's been some really cool promising outlooks into these. I was talking about these kelp meatballs that they're making. They're not actually meat, but it's like 33% kelp, 33% chickpeas, and then this flavor package, and they're putting them in schools all over the East Coast, which is pretty exciting. The kids are, if the kids are liking it, it's got to be decent. So I thought they were really good, but I'm also biased. So a number of different products. Most of my kelp so far has gone into human food.
Well, you've obviously benefited from financial resources to get off the ground. Are you at a point now where you've got a market and a price point that allows you to not have to rely on other sources of free money?
Through the chair. So at this point, I'm kind of juggling three jobs. So in short, no. But I think that a lot of that comes from bills that were accorded when I was a fisherman. So, you can't change decisions you made 20 years ago, like how much my house costs, things like that. A lot of this work that I'm doing with Build Back Better is part of that. So it's kind of grant funded. I'm also part of an EBOS project where they're looking at marine mammal interaction and ecosystem services that are happening at these farms. It's not a huge amount of money, but it definitely helps. And then aside from that, I have a contract written with my processor that not only do I sell them a kelp at a reduced per pound rate, but I receive a monthly stipend for doing other work for them as well. So I've found a creative way to make this work for me is the real answer. I'd also like to add oysters. I think that'll make a farm a lot more, unique and able to be on its own. But I do have a hard time encouraging people to quit their day job and have a kelp farm. I think it's more of something that just broadens your portfolio, allows you to use the knowledge and skill set that you already have while maybe creating something cool for the environment in and around your farm.
Follow up.
I guess another question. The concept of farmers having to work off the farm is not new, and that just is a reality that we face as small farmers. Wish it wasn't so, but that's kind of the environment we have. We had to get laser focused on who our customer was. It sounds like that's kind of where you're at. So I'm encouraged. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Representative Kim Chu.
Thank you. Through the chair, can you talk about the combo farms a little bit? Like, you're using the same acreage to grow oysters and kelp? How does that work?
Yeah, through the chair. I guess it's the added benefit of just adding a species to your existing farm. In some cases, you have to change the anchoring systems because there's need for added weight or security. But there's some early signs that oysters and mussels and kelp all really kind of help each other to grow better and quicker. So I think that's one of the ideas, but it's more about, like you said, the leasing and not having to lease a whole nother subplot just to grow oysters. And in a lot of ways, you're already accessing that area. So,
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. And this question is for the three of us. Because 2 years ago or 3 years ago, we did that Blue Ocean strategy thing. Wouldn't this kind of thing fit into that? I mean, we went through this big resolution and this whole thing about supporting the Blue Ocean strategy. And seems to me here we have a perfect candidate for that. I don't know. Maybe it's something that you want to look at, but there was a big push a couple of years ago when we were here on fisheries and this whole Blue Ocean idea sort of fits in with the carbon sequestration and developing new markets and new ways to use what we already have, the resources we already have, such as kelp and the, and I mean, you're obviously using the ocean, if you will, kind of as your fertilizer, right? I mean, you don't necessarily spread fertilizer around in the ocean. I think DNR and EPA would be kind of mad about that, but so you're using sort of what we have to grow something. It's, I think it's kind of cool as well.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Through the chair. Excuse me. Nick, do you have much interaction with Tomi down here from Southeast? I know she does a lot of kelp food products.
Yeah, through the chair. Yes. Actually just did a nursery training that was sponsored by them down in Ketchikan just to learn more about the whole life cycle of oysters. At this point, I haven't. It's even harder to get kelp within the state than it is out of the state, if that makes any sense. It's when we were looking at providing barnacle with 20,000 pounds, the cheapest method we found to get it to Juneau was literally Alaska Airlines, like chartering an Alaska Airlines jet and going air cargo. It was cheaper and more reliable than, because you can't go Matson, you got to go all the way to Seattle and turn around and switch. So transport within the state is definitely another complicated thing.
Interesting.
So how many people do you employ on your farm? Because the conversations that we've had is that, and you've mentioned this, this is a great alternative for fishermen, you know, in between seasons. So how many people do you employ, and what impact is that having in your community?
Thank you for the question. So as far as a farmer goes, I have done quite a bit of this on my own, but what we have really helped sustain is the processor employs around 14 employees that weren't currently employed for about a month and a half, and that's just my one farm. So it's been a dramatic increase in that area. As far as what we're doing, there's been so much help because of the RPE project that we had a whole team of, in essence, free workers out there, to be honest. I always make sure that I have a high schooler with me every year and pay them well, because I think it's most important to get the kids involved and interested, because we're not sustainable without that. But I haven't really ever, as far as on the farming side of things, hired anyone full-time. It's more like day labor, and it's a pretty short season as far as what we're doing on the water, because we've figured out how to do it pretty efficiently. But the processing side of it, I think that's where the real impact comes in.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Along that very line, do you have Addie or Kelson out there helping you?
Through the chair, yeah. Kelson coiled all of my land last year.
Really?
So, yeah.
And how old 15 is Kelson?
Year old.
She's 15.
No, she's 16 now, but yeah, it was pretty cool.
Representative Hemshoop.
Thank you, through the chair. Do you have a way to dry kelp right now? Do you have a drying facility?
Through the chair. So there is a project that's being built right next to the main processor, which is Native owned in Kodiak. Shunack Tribe owns Wild Source, and they do most of the custom processing through lease agreements with other processors. So basically they use their facility. They use their workforce, but they do their own custom processing to their spec. They won a matching grant that's issued through the governor, and are building out the facility. The dryer's there, but it's not in place yet. There's not, to my knowledge, a real large-scale drying happening anywhere, but very small scale, yes. And as Representative McCabe mentioned earlier, Kodiak is an extremely tough place to dry things. Last year, I tried to do it in a greenhouse, and it was like such high and low, you know, even with fans on it, I'd wake up and go there every day and it'd be wet again, you know. So it's not as easy as just laying it out. We went to Korea through this World Wildlife Fund project that this video kind of came out of. We went there to learn how are they drying it. And the answer is they've got tarps covering fields and they lay it outside, which we will never be able to do here because the weather will not allow it.
Representative Stutes and then Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought there was a drying machine over at the Kodiak Marine Science Center over on your island.
Through the chair, very small scale, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. but very labor intensive for very small amounts of kelp. One thing that we have been trying to do is get the BioDry to do a process with us of some kind, because that's one of the most sophisticated fish meal plants on the West Coast, but they're afraid of it a little bit.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Carpenter. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, what is the product that you would create if you had a drying process? What is the market demand right now for a dried product?
So through the chair, there's a number of different dried milled products, basically a powder or a flake, and the market seems to be somewhere around $30 to $40 a pound right now from East Coast, from the East Coast. There's also stuff that's coming out of Wild Harvest, and that's one of the things we're up against. It's kind of like the opposite of fish, because, you know, Norway and Iceland is producing all this farm fish and we're having trouble selling the wild, and it's the opposite for us. We're having this really nice farm product where they're actually wild harvesting, which is detrimental in this case. So they're harvesting rockweed and certain kinds of kelp. So until we put labels on those things and figure out how to differentiate what we're growing and the value of that to what is being wild harvested and put it into the dried market. But they're not having much problem, as far to my knowledge, selling their dried product coming out of Maine and the East Coast. And they've got a very large scale dryer there that they built in, I think, South Africa. And it's for the first time ever in use this month because they're already harvesting there.
Follow up.
Thank you. And through the chair, so your ultimate goal here, at least one of them, is to find a process and a market for dried kelp. And I would assume that low-cost energy is something that is going to be necessary for that to even be feasible.
Yeah, through the chair, I think I wanted to come today to more educate about what our farms look like, what they're doing, and not, we don't really have an ask. Other than maybe when you guys shape these programs and the things that you're doing and thinking about energy, that this be a part of that, because it would be really useful. It's got a ton of potential. This industry does have a ton of potential, but we need to shape the right policies and things around it. So in short, yeah, I guess I really hope that there's a dried market. I hope there's a wet market. I just hope that Alaska can, like many other things that are done, and the marine sector be the leader.
And this will be my last. It was a kind of a leading question, but I'm not expecting you to be asking for anything.
Yeah.
Folks like you and I are few and far between in this building. Mm-hmm. The entrepreneurial spirit and challenges that we have in trying to accomplish something is a message that needs to be louder in this building. So I appreciate you coming and sharing what you're trying to do. I recognize the challenges that you're up against, and it is entrepreneurs, individuals who are trying to create an industry, create wealth, create business, who need to be supported. And one of the things that you're going to need to require any agriculture processing facility is going to need low cost energy, period. End of story. Mm-hmm. We can't have a storage facility without low cost energy. We can't have a processing facility without low cost energy. All of those are things that we have to, anyway, the reason why we need that is for people like you. Thank you for coming.
Well, through the chair, thank you.
Thank you, Nick. I think we met last year and kept bumping into each other at different, you know, mariculture and fishery meetings and things like that. And this is an up and coming industry. It's emerging, and I want to do whatever we can to help it grow, because it's an alternative to our coastal communities. And the different uses is just fascinating to me, that we could really, we could impact, you know, the environment and food and agriculture, you know, in so many ways. And it's exciting, and I really appreciate you coming. Nick, are you going to be here for the rest of the day?
Madam Chair, no.
He has a harvest to get back to, I think.
But yeah, can I just say one thing in closing?
Yes.
Is that I had a chance to spend some time with Senator Sullivan this last few days, and when he was in Comfish. And one of the things that he said that resonated with me really well is, you know, what we're seeing right now coming out of the seafood industry is that this economic warfare is really directed towards Alaska. And in speaking with him, I feel like that even more so, it's really hyper-focused on Southwest Alaska, because we don't have any other industries to fall back on. You know, we don't have the tourism that you guys are blessed with here. And so I just hope that industries like this could be a part of the solution to that problem more than anything. But we need to figure out these markets, like you say, and figure out what the worth and value is here, and how to get more people involved, and how to get cheaper energy into these places. So I guess it's unfortunate to see that it's coming into fruition like it is, because I had hoped we had more time, and you know, none of us could have seen this coming with seafood industry. I thought it was going to be more like a decline in stocks, not economic warfare. So it's really unfortunate, but I think that there's also hope. So,
well, thank you for
thank coming. You all for your time
and for your information and just really coming when you have a harvest. So this just happened to be when we could get him in, and we didn't have the meeting canceled. So we will take a brief at ease before we transition to House Bill 297. For our second and final agenda item today, we will now bring back House Bill 297, Sport Fish Angler Access Surcharge by the Governor, as presented by ADF&G in its third hearing. There are two amendments before us today. So, Rep. McCabe, are you ready to move amendment number one?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment one.
Check for discussion.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So all this amendment does is add $1 to the proposed surcharge in the governor's bill from Fish and Game, and the intent of that $1 would be to for them to do this report that we talked about and I handed out at the last meeting. There's some more amplifying information on how much that would garner for the department, and we're contemplating putting a sunset date on this, but in talking with the commissioner, his idea was that he would do one of these reports periodically instead of waiting, I think, almost 20 years since the last one is done, so maybe every three to five years. So having that fund accrue would be fine, and any excess, I think, would be, this bill itself is an important bill for helping access to fishing areas. And I think that any excess that came after the report was done could be well spent in that arena. So that's the bill. Essentially, it just adds a dollar.
Questions on amendment number one? Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you, Chair Vance. So through the chair, the way it works is we add the dollar on, so they have the money they need to do it, and then there's legislative intent language, and that's the direction to do it. But really, this would be at the discretion of the department to use that extra dollar, however they choose to, need to, whatever. Is there anything in here that I'm just missing it that requires that we get that report every 10 years, or?
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, and through the chair, no, we didn't really put any requirements in there. Our intent was just like all the projects that are sort of mentioned or were mentioned in the governor's presentation, we just said, hey, let's add a dollar. And oh, by the way, let's add this project as one of your projects. And I think that the commissioner felt that it was important enough and maybe one that we hadn't considered that would be one of the projects. So no, we didn't put any hard and fast language, thou must do this. So my guess is, and if I could continue, sorry, Madam Chair, but my guess is that the sport fish anglers in Sitka and South Central and other places will, knowing that this is in there, will be more insistent on getting that report every periodically. One of the other things I wanted to mention, I think that the total that the department figured out would be about $380,000 or so, and Joe can tell us better, but also that the report, because the structure has been done before, might not be as expensive as it was. So instead of, we talked at the last meeting, we might have to wait 2 years for the fund to accrue. I think they could do that maybe without that waiting period and maybe even have a little money left over, because the people that did the report already have the structure and the idea, and they don't have to put a whole bunch of things together. So it was actually kind of good news. It would leave a little bit of money left over for some of these more, some of the other projects that we mentioned the other day. So
follow up.
Thank you, through the chair. On line 13 of the amendment, it says the commissioner shall produce and disseminate to the public a biennial report on the economic impacts of sport fishing in the state. Is that that big document you shared with us, or this is a smaller report?
Well, that's a good question. I think that's probably better directed to, through the chair, better directed to Joe, what the commissioner envisions for that.
Mr. Feckel, if you could please state your name for the record.
For the record, Joe Feckel, legislative liaison for the Department of Fish and Game. Through the chair, Representative Himshute, in discussing this with the commissioner and our division of sport team, it is a biennial report, so we would be issuing a report every 2 years. Our thoughts are the initial one would be statewide, and then we may issue some regional reports every 2 years while still refreshing the state one, statewide one periodically. So it would be initially that large report that was provided to the committee, and then we would branch out into regional reports and then routinely update the statewide report. And I will defer to the commissioner if he'd like to add anything.
Through the chair, this is Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Joe is exactly right. We would plan to use this money to do the statewide survey on a 4 or 5 year basis, and then any additional money that would be in there for that, from that dollar surcharge, we would do more regionally focused economic. And the reason this is important is that part of the mission or the function of the commissioner is to do management of our fisheries in the best interest of the economy. And oftentimes we struggle with getting economic information to the Board of Fish and other allocated bodies that are making decisions. So this information is critical towards getting that information in front of the boards.
Follow up, Representative Himshute.
Thank you. Through the chair. I really support this. I think this is fantastic. The only question that I still have is if we have a different commissioner or whatever, is there enough here? Because I love the plan. If you do regional reports, then that feeds into your every 5 years or whatever. And it is the gigantic task that it is to do it every 20 years. So that all makes sense to me. But is the language in here enough to spell that out for, you know, as we transition through leadership in the department, do we need to spell out more clearly the expectations for this funding and to get that report that we know we need?
Through the chair, Representative Hsu, we listened very carefully when you guys passed these kinds of bills with the intent that you have the money going towards. And to the extent that we don't follow through with that commitment, then we are going to be struggling in the future to convince you that when you give us some additional money with clear intent to do that, if we don't follow that, we're probably not going to get it in the future. So I think your intent is clear here, and I understand it, and I think future commissioners will also understand it and not risk the chance of not getting additional money because they didn't follow through on the legislative intent of a previous bill.
Thank you. I appreciate the latitude and the trust for placing the department. Thanks.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question regarding the publication that would be created. So the bill before us is a licensing bill of raising the fee of a license, but the license that we're talking about are sport fishing, resident, non-resident, and military sport fishing licenses. We're not talking about licenses for other commercial activity like guides, sport fishing guides, for example. So would the dollars that we're going to be charging Alaskans to produce a report, would that statewide survey include an assessment of the commercial sport fishing activities that are occurring in the state, or is it just an assessment of what is happening with regard to the licenses that are being that are funding the report?
Through the chair, this would capture the value of sport fishing, both guided and unguided, because everybody that's guided needs a sport fishing license. So we would be able to capture both of those probably as subcategories to the overall estimate of the value of sport fishing.
Follow up. Do you also produce a report on the value of commercial fishing activity in the state?
There are numerous reports put out in terms of on the value of commercial fishing by a variety of different bodies. I think we build on those and provide that, but there are a lot of that work is done outside of the department by McKinley Group and other groups that are out there.
Follow up.
Thank you. So the answer is that the department will put out a report on the assessment of sport fishing activity, but it won't put out something specifically on commercial fishing activity. Is that correct?
Yeah, not using these dollars. The other thing that we'll capture with this money is probably personal use fishery economic value, because right now we have no assessment of that, but people that participate in personal use fisheries need to have a sport fishing license.
Are there dollars allocated through other fees, structures in the commercial fishing regulation that capture, that are available to be used for a report to explain to Alaskans the value of commercial fishing activity in the state?
Not directly in terms of the license fee structure that's currently set in statute. You could amend those statutes and say that the commercial licensing fees as well as the crew member fees would have a dollar surcharge on them to pay for that economic interest if you wanted to, but that's not currently what's in front of you.
Thank you. Would the department be able to make an assessment on the value of commercial fishing activities in the state with the dollar figures associated with the increase in these fees? It wouldn't be the first time that one user group paid for benefit for other user groups. Just curious if the department would be able to skin two cats here with the same money.
Through the chair, it would be hard to use the money collected from sport fishing license fee holders to do, for instance, an economic valuation of the commercial scallop fishery. So I think what we would get from this is a more clear picture of the overall economic value of fishing to the state of Alaska, because what we're currently missing is the piece on personal use and sport fishing. And this will update that information so we have a more complete picture on overall valuation of fishing to the state.
Thank you. Follow up.
I
guess I'm just trying to figure out a fair way forward here, because there's fishermen down on the Kenai who have not been able to fish in several years, and it is a economic hardship for our community. And it would be unfair, I think, for the legislature to point to the value of one fishing group and not point to the value of another. And therefore, it kind of is a lopsided communication from the state as to where the value is. And that's what I'm concerned about, is why it wouldn't be also be a desire of the administration to communicate to the public why commercial fishing is also important, not just sport fishing.
So, I might, Madam Chair.
Representative McCabe.
So this amendment is tightly focused on personal use fisheries because they have no advocacy group. So the commercial fisheries have a ton of different advocacy groups that produce these reports that are then collated further produced by or passed out by the department. But you and I and those of us that own a sport fishing license and go salmon fishing, once a day or once a week or whatever, we have no advocacy group that can put those kinds of reports together. So point being is the commercial fisheries and the commercial fishermen already have plenty of data to support them and to support their various needs, but you and I don't. So that was all the intent of this $1 addition was about.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. I'm not necessarily opposed to having a report. I'm just looking for policies that treat all fishermen equal. And we have, while there are advocates for commercial fishermen through their organizations, we don't have policies that allow commercial fishermen to fish. We do not have the same problem with sport fishermen or personal use. They are able to fish. They are able to find some place to fish.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. I appreciate what Representative Carpenter is saying, but we do have that advocacy through the Board of Fish and through the department in their management of our fisheries. So if you're talking about the ability to fish, which it sounds like you're talking about, that's something different than what this bill is addressing, I believe.
Representative Carpenter.
Not actually, because what the report would do would be to communicate to the public the value of sport fishing, right? If that was the only thing that the public read from the state was, here's the value of sport fishing, we might be, it might be understood that that is the only value of our fishing industry is through the sport fishing policies that we have. If we're not communicating to the public what the value of commercial fishing is, then over time you see a declining of the interest of commercial fishing because nobody knows that there's value there. That's what my concern is.
Madam Chair.
Representative Stutes.
This will be my last comment in order to avoid a he said, she said type of thing. But I believe we get that because when you listen, they're always talking about the commercial fishery being the largest private employer in the state of Alaska. And you can quote several different entities that can tell you how much they contribute to the state coffers, how much they contribute to the economy of the state. You can go right down the line. So I think the point is, and at least the point that I'm receiving is, we have that information available. In relation to commercial fisheries. We don't have that information available in relation to sport fisheries, and this enables that. At least that's how I'm interpreting it. Thank you.
I'm going to speak up here. I think the difference, Representative Stutes, is that in the Cook Inlet, it is a very different situation. And I'm going to respectfully disagree with the sponsor of this amendment in that there is an organization who could fund, who speaks very well for sport fishing and personal use, who could fund this project, much like the commercial fishermen groups fund their assessment of economic impact and provide that information in partnership with the department. But it is not originated in the department. And the bigger question that we have here is, are we going to add a dollar surcharge to every sport fish license to pay for something that could be funded by a very prominent sport fishing and personal use fishery group? A very well-funded and well-supported group. So I represent all the fishermen. I have every single one of them in my district. So I'm not opposed to this. But I, like Representative Carpenter, want to ask, what are we doing that is treating every fishing group in fairness so that we can have a clear economic picture of the value. Because I think this report is a valuable tool, but what I'm afraid that it will be used for specifically in the Cook Inlet is to say, see, sport fishing has a higher economic impact and value to our communities than comfish. And that I think the misuse of this tool is what my commercial fishermen at Cook Inlet will not be satisfied with, because that argument is already very, very present. So that's the tension that you are hearing from those of us in the Cook Inlet, because it's not the fish wars are in the Cook Inlet, and everyone's well aware of that. It's been longstanding. The bigger question that we have as a decision right now is, are we going to agree that a dollar surcharge that really every, I don't know who doesn't get a sport fish license, right, will absorb this cost? And is that the right decision moving forward? So that's in all simplicity. I think what I'm hearing is that everyone sees the value of the report, but do we feel it's the right decision to add this dollar surcharge tax at this time? So Representative Hemshute and then Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Through the chair, I guess one way to look at this potentially is CFEC tracks the value in commercial fisheries, and I don't know of a CFEC similar organization in sport fisheries. And so for the department, and I would maybe even ask a question of the department, is there a similar report right now issued periodically from the department that parallels this report? So, because I did see a report at one point about the contributions of commercial fishing to Alaska through taxes and that kind of thing. Don't know where I got that from or when it was published or even who published it, but feels like the information is there in Comfish and hasn't been compiled into a report that I know of, whereas in Sportfish, the information is less consolidated, possibly. Either way, I support the idea of having maximum information, but I can see the concerns in your region. I would like to have more information about sport fishing in my region, maybe for some of the same reasons. But I guess if I had a question for the department, it is, do we have anyone producing a report on commercial fisheries that would parallel what's being asked for in this amendment?
For the record, Joe Felkel, legislative liaison for the department. As the commissioner mentioned, the department does not issue a report on the economic impacts of the commercial fishing industry. However, the McKinley Research Group issues a report, I believe it's every 2 years, if I'm not mistaken. And we at the department have cited to that data before. But again, we, the department, do not issue that study.
Follow up. Thank you. Through the chair, who funds that study? They're not just doing it because they want to.
I believe, for the record, Joe Felkel, I believe it's the industry, but I could be mistaken. I'm speaking off the cuff here.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think your point is very well taken, and I think it shines a different light on the whole thing. And so I guess I would like to ask the maker of the amendment if he sees the issue that is at hand when the commercial industry has this provided by their own industry as to why the state should provide this when the sport fish industry has the ability of doing the same.
Yeah. Through the chair, thanks. Thanks for that. So yes, the Cook Inlet Drift Netters and the Eastside Cook Inlet Fishermen all have a report issued from the McKinley group that talks to their plight, and I totally understand that. Saying that their plight is any different than the entire sport fishing industry in South Central Alaska being closed to all fisheries. Those folks don't have an advocacy group that can say, this is how much it cost the sporting goods store's business in Wasilla, Palmer, Anchorage, because all of our fisheries are closed to sport fishing. So we don't have that kind of advocacy. You're talking about the Kenai River Sportsmen's Association, who is tightly focused on the Kenai River, because that's in their name, Kenai River Sportsmen's Association. Their focus is on rebuilding and rehabbing the Kenai River. They aren't going to come to the Deshka River. We have no Deshka River Sportsmen's Association. They're not necessarily going to go down to Sitka and deal with the rivers down there. So if that's the group that you're talking about, I would respectfully disagree that they certainly could if they wanted to, but that's not their focus. So because they rarely get any money from anybody that just fishes the Deshka. So I'm not sure why this group here is exacerbating the battle, if you will, over $1 when we 2 years ago did away with a $10 surcharge that was designed to help hatcheries. And the sportsmen are clearly telling us that they wouldn't mind an extra dollar for this kind of report, if you will, that they can use to say, they can absolutely use it to say, yes, Commissioner, but this is the economic impact of closing the fisheries in South Central, and actually have the data. Nobody knows right now. Nobody knows how Sportsman's Warehouse or some of the other businesses are going to suffer from the loss of all the fishing this summer, or great majority of the fishing in South Central. So I think it's data we need to have, and I think the transparency is important for the resource, frankly, and for resource managers, including the Board of Fish and including the many other people that have an impact on our fisheries, whatever it be, commercial or sport fishing. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Representative Suits.
I will just make one brief comment, because I can see that you also have some. But to suggest that Kenai River Sports Association is localized to the Kenai River is a misnomer. That just isn't the case. And they're a very well-heeled organization. And so it wouldn't be out of the ordinary to ask them to participate, I wouldn't think, in something like this. Not to say that I'm opposed to your amendment, but I understand a little more clearly Representative Carpenter's position in this as well. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I do have a question for the commissioner. Based upon, I mean, you're making very valid arguments, Representative McCabe, in looking at the economic value to management decisions, which is the same argument that Representative Carpenter is making. So, Commissioner, how will the department use this report for economic value in management decisions? And what is your constitutional mandate? What comes first? Is it sustaining the resource or the economy?
Madam Chair, so my job is to manage the resource in sustained yield so that we, not one generation takes fisheries at the expense of future generation. We want to make sure that there's a sustained yield of the resource. But we're also supposed to manage that in the best interest of the economy and well-being of the people of the state of Alaska. So as people that make allocated decisions on the Board of Fish and Board of Game make those decisions, part of the factor that they factor into those decisions is economic information. And again, I've reported back to the legislature numerous times that you guys should expect from natural resources a return on investment for the best for the people of Alaska. For my ability to report on the return on investment that you're giving to the department, and my placing that and giving an investment back to the state, economic information is critical towards that. Again, we didn't introduce this as part of the surcharge bill, but clearly right now we support it because that information is being provided already on the commercial sector. You can argue about who's paying for it or how it's being paid for, but it's missing for across much of our state for the sport fishing and personal use fisheries. So this is an opportunity to have sport fishermen and personal use fishermen who pay license fees to start collecting that information to inform regulatory bodies and inform the department about the value of those fisheries and the relative return on investment we're providing to the legislature for those resources.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think Mr. Felkel had a follow-up.
For the record, Joe Felkel, I just wanted to jump in real quick and speak to an earlier question that kind of relates to this discussion. I did pull up the McKinley Research report that was issued in 2020, and it was actually prepared for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. So I don't know what the costs that went into that report, but I do just want to confirm that it was a state entity that McKinley prepared the report for.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to say that while we're having this discussion, I'm not at all opposed to the $1 increase. That's not the problem. I'm not opposed to the concept of more and better data for sport fishing. What I'm noticing is the lack of other fisheries being included in this. And I have commercial fishing interests in my district. There are others that would likely join this argument and say, well, what about the economic impact of subsistence fishing that isn't happening, right? To some people in the state, that's probably a life and death situation, whereas commercial fishing can go get another job if they can't fish, right? If the commissioner is going to produce and disseminate to the public a biennial report on the economic impacts of only sport fishing, then it seems to me that the pendulum would be swung to only one of the resources' economic impacts when you have policies that this would inform of subsistence and commercial fishing that would not be in this report. So it would be not whole, if you will, a not whole report coming from the department, from the state, on what the health of our economic, the value of the economic impact to the state is. We're just focusing on one particular user group. And I think that that would be a mistake of us. Now, does $1 off of the sport fishing licenses get us to a point where the commissioner and his staff can create a report and pull from data that is available in other locations and other publications in order to communicate to the public value of the entire fishery as opposed to just one user group? I don't think that's unreasonable. If there's a report that's from 2020 from ASME or CFEC or data that's available, I don't understand why the administration wouldn't be able to use that and put it in a footnote that this is the value coming from these organizations. And it's comparatively, or to build a bigger picture of the total value of our resources instead of just focusing specifically on sport fishing. I think that would be more valuable to Alaskans and to policymakers than just focusing on the narrow sport fishing lane. And I understand the kind of the disparity here of you're only going to have the sport fishing pay for it. But I mean, several hundred thousand dollars to commission a report from which part of that source of that report would be data that is paid for and collected by other organizations, and the department would just reference it. Seems like it's not that big of a deal.
Representative Carpenter, I think I'm not going to speak for the department, but we haven't given them the statutory direction to do so until this amendment is specifically saying address that. So I guess the question that I have, Representative Carpenter, you mentioned subsistence, and I know that in the budget there is a subsistence director being funded. This is question is either for the commissioner or for Mr. Felkel. Does the department need statutory direction to issue a report of the economic impacts in any fishery or, for instance, specifically subsistence?
For the record, Joe Felkel, I would just like to note that our subsistence team does issue a report on the value of subsistence food. The last one was 2017. It was issued in 2018 based on a 2017 year review. And I'll defer to the commissioner if he has any other comments on, you know, statutory direction and the work of the department.
Yeah, through the chair, Madam Chair, we pieced together this information on economics. So we have McKinley Group working with ASME to provide information on the commercial fisheries. We really don't have a funding source to do much on the sport fishing side statewide, so this would provide that information there. The subsistence division or subsistence section routinely or periodically puts out an assessment of the relative value of the subsistence resource taken by subsistence users. And that has been used by us to give a better estimate of how the subsistence community has been affected by fishing disasters. And we've used that in terms of developing the spend plans. Unfortunately, we really don't have a very good estimate. And we have a good estimate for commercial fisheries as those spend plans, but we really don't have a good estimate of some of the impacts in some of the areas outside of Cook Inlet to give us a good estimate of how the sport fish charter industry or the sport fishing user group has been economically impacted due to fisheries disasters in there, again, in areas outside of Cook Inlet. So this would provide us that information. Is there a comprehensive report done annually? No, but all those pieces come together when there's a thing like a disaster that occurs that is pieced together to form and develop a spend plan.
Thank you, Commissioner. So for the sake of time, because we have about 8 minutes left of committee, I will give Representative McCabe's opportunity for a final wrap up on his amendment before we consider, since there's been robust discussion.
I would like to consider an amendment to the amendment.
Representative Carpenter.
And this is a conceptual amendment that would just change line 14 to include economic impacts of subsistence, commercial, and sport fishing in the state. So adding the words subsistence and commercial prior to sport in that sentence. And it seems to me that the data that would be necessary for that type of a comprehensive report is already being collected by other organizations that the administration could point to. And the funding source from the underlying amendment would help them gather the data that they are lacking in the sport area.
So would you make the motion?
I move amendment, conceptual amendment number one to amendment number one, to add the words subsistence, comma, commercial, comma, before the word sport on line 14.
Page one or page two?
Page one.
Object.
There's been an objection. Any debate on conceptual amendment? Okay. Would the secretary please call the roll on a conceptual amendment number one to amendment number one?
Representative Stutes.
Excuse me. Would you repeat the amendment, please?
Representative Carpenter, would you restate your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. The conceptual amendment one to amendment number one is to add the words, and I am on page one, looking at line 14. It will add the words subsistence, comma, commercial, comma, before the word sport on line 14.
Oxford comma, you need the word and if possible.
Yes.
Oxford commas are okay.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Would you please restart the vote? Would the secretary please begin again?
Representative Stutes.
Yes.
Representative Carpenter.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Hushu.
Yes.
Representative McCabe.
No.
Representative McCormick.
Yes.
Chair Vance.
Yes.
5 yeas and 2 nays.
By a vote of 5 yeas and 2 nays, conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 1 has passed. So that brings us back to amendment number 1 as conceptually amended. Are we ready for the vote on amendment number 1? Representative McCabe.
Before we do that, Madam Chair, are we, so we're running out of time to do the Second Amendment, so you're going to hold this?
Brief at ease. Representative Johnson.
Object.
There has been an objection. Representative Carpenter, would you like to speak to your objection?
Well, I think there may be interested parties at this table who want to see the amendment passed. So we'll find out.
Representative Hemshue.
Thank you, through the chair. This may not be an appropriate time to ask this question, but are the resources there to provide all three reports? Did we just?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. The last time thank you, Madam Chair. The last time a report was done was 2017 on sports fishing only, and it cost around $300,000. So you could easily triple that, or at least half that. So you're talking about quite a substantial amount of money over the period. And I don't think this licensure, if you look at the physical note, I don't think this bill would cover that. So that's why I'm opposed. That's why I support a tabling motion. I don't think this is the place or time to be throwing in the other user groups.
Representative Stutes on the objection to table.
Madam Chair, I would support the tabling just to allow the maker of the amendment to have an opportunity. But to say you're going to triple it, I think is not true. The information is there. It's just a matter of compiling it and putting it in a report. It's been said by both the commissioner, by the department, both subsistence and commercial fishing information is available currently.
Representative McCabe.
So thank you, Madam Chair. The last time this report was done was 2007. 2017 was a subsistence report, I believe, or the data for the 2018 subsistence report. So more than a decade after this report was done, we just gave ASME $5 million. They'll probably get more. And they develop the reports for the commercial fishing industry. So all this $1 amendment would do would be to provide information so that the Board of Fish, and it's actually, there's a statute that requires that all fisheries be treated equally. It's AS 16.05.251 requires consideration of the importance of each fishery to the economy of the state. In the economy of the state, the region and local area which the fishery is located in. We haven't done one for this fishery since 2007. So this dollar is an attempt not to fix all the problems in Cook Inlet, not to fix the problems with the east side drift netters, not even to fix the problems with the south central sports fishermen. All this is data was going to do, this report was going to do, was to provide data to the Board of Fish and the department so they could more easily make allocation decisions under the statute I just read. They would have the information to do that. So I'm okay with tabling this right now for a future discussion since we're already past our time.
Okay, would the secretary please call the roll on the motion to table amendment number one?
Representative Carpenter.
No.
Representative C. Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Hemshue.
Yes.
Representative McCain.
Yes.
Representative McCormick.
Yes.
Representative Stoops.
Yes.
Chair Vance.
Yes.
Six yeas and one nay.
Six yeas and one nay. Amendment number one has been tabled. So due to the constraints of time and a robust discussion, we will set House Bill 297 aside for a future date. So that concludes our business for today. The House Committee, Special Committee on Fisheries, will meet again at a time to be determined depending on our floor sessions. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn at 12:02 p.m.